Esther Men. And this week I've been giving a series of sessions on, I call it The Power of the Powerless, Women Who Shaped Biblical History. And we've seen that there were women at every stage of the story, which is recorded in the Old Testament, the story of the Hebrew people. And this is despite the fact that the structures of the society were patriarchal, so the males held the power. But we've seen some very strong characters, Rebecca and Tamar, the midwives, Moses' mother and sister, and then the three warriors of yesterday, Rahab and Deborah and Yael. Today we're going to look at one final figure, and that's Esther. And I think I called it Esther and the People's Survival. I could have also called it From Beauty Queen to Political Activist. And I like this book. I like the title of it best of all. But, as we read it, listen to what you hear about the character of Esther too. It's interesting. This is a later book, and it's her character and her role are perhaps a little different than the other characters that we've been looking at. The book of Esther was written much later, actually, than the material that we've been looking at. It's written after the Babylonian exile, in around 587 BC, the big Babylonian empire came down and crushed the little nation of Judah and Jerusalem and burnt the temple and took all the wealthy and educated people into captivity. Well, the Babylonians themselves fell to the Persians not too long after. And so you have then a group of Jews living in what became Persia. And the setting here is in the capital city of Susa. And there is a Jewish community there. This is the beginning, actually, of what's called the Jewish diaspora, which means, it's a Greek word that means to scatter out. So after the Babylonian exile, there were people in different parts of the world besides that area that's known as Israel today. And so this is considered the beginning of the diaspora, the scattering of the Jewish people. And we'll notice that the people are in danger because they're out of their own country. They don't have control anymore of the government. And they're living within another government, and a government which can turn hostile. It's interesting to look at the attitude towards the foreign king here in Esther. And it's not, you'll notice that there's not an attitude that the foreign king or government is something that's inherently evil or anything. It's just a sort of a, notice the king, he gets angry easily and he acts on impulse. And then he thinks about it a little bit, but you know, whatever he's decided is already law and you can't change the law of the king of Persia. So there's this, and he's also very easily influenced, you'll find. So the attitude toward the government is not one that says, okay, these foreign governments are evil, but they aren't necessarily friendly and they're just kind of very fickle, I guess. And so this people is living in this situation. The book of Esther, as we'll see, it is read every year at a festival, at a Jewish holiday, although actually it's not really a religious holiday, it's more of a kind of secular holiday, called Purim. And Purim takes place in the late winter, in February or early March. And the word Purim itself means lots, you know, the kind of lots you cast to make decisions about things. And it was called Purim because the arch enemy here in the book named Haman, he cast lots to decide what day was a good day to put all the Jews to death. So it's called lots. because this day was turned, the day which Haman decided was a good day to exterminate all the Jews, was turned into a day of feasting and gladness because the people are saved. I was on a kibbutz in 1981, I guess it was, for the Purim festival. So I was in Israel in this little community in the Negev desert on this collective farm. And they had a Purim festival. Now, in general, the kibbutz is a very hard-working, serious place, and people don't drink a lot of beer, and they don't wear fancy clothes or anything like that. They have kind of a work ethic. But on this day, on Purim, there was a sudden transformation, and everybody dressed up in costumes, from the little guy to the big guy. Everybody's dressed up in costumes, and there was an open bar. I mean, this is really unusual, because the people that drank the most beer there were the volunteers, you know, the foreigners. But there was an open bar, and you were supposed to drink. The custom is you're supposed to drink so much that you can't tell the difference between a white thread and a black thread when they're held up. And I never tried. I never really experimented to see how much I had, but there were some tipsy people, and as I say, that was really atypical. And then also, well, they had some other festivities, and boy, it was like our Mardi Gras. I mean, they're really puritanical, the people on this kibbutz, but they had some X-rated movies, things like this. It was really strange. And so it's really kind of a release. You know, in most cultures have one day of the year where people really act in very unusual and sort of, I don't know, outgoing, sort of liberated ways, kind of a release of tension or whatever. And this is their festival. And it's interesting that it celebrates the salvation of the people, the survival of the people after a potential extinction. And because the Jewish people have been threatened so often with annihilation, I think this story is particularly strong for them. Now, during this festival, everybody's all dressed up and, you know, people are drinking and there's games and everything. Right in the middle of this, you have a reading of the book of Esther, of the whole book. And people love it. They have noisemakers, you know, those things that you go like this with. And whenever the character of Haman comes in, who's the one who plots to have all the Jews annihilated, people go, "Ooh, boo," like this. So if anybody feels like entering into that spirit, you're welcome to do that. Or, you know, when Mordecai comes in, there's clapping and noise making and whistling and so forth. So it's really treated as a kind of melodrama. And it's interesting that the name of God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. It's really, it appears, at least on the surface, to be a secular book. There's one mention of, one indication, and we'll look at that a little closer, that God's acting behind the scenes to ensure the survival of the people. But there's no mention of the name of God in the book itself. And perhaps that's deliberate in order that at this festival where everybody's acting crazy and drunk, you know, you don't have some kind of sacrilege happening. You don't have somebody messing up and, I don't know, laughing at the wrong, you know, laughing at the name of God or something. So anyway, that's one possibility. But we'll read parts of it, tell parts of it too. It's kind of long. It's 10 chapters, so can't read the whole thing.
How long is the festival going, as far as you know?
How long historically?
Was it even done the time of Christ for this to be something?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. At least by the time of the Mishnah, this is the second century A.D. But the Mishnah also records earlier things. There was a discussion of whether the Book of Esther should be in the Bible or out, really, whether it should be part of the canon or not. And since it refers to the Festival of Purim in it. So, yeah. Actually, the book seems to be a kind of an institution of this festival. If you look at the, we'll look at the last chapter of it, and it tells how to celebrate this festival. It doesn't have all the stuff about dressing up and drinking and all that kind of stuff, but it's supposed to be a festival of gladness where you give gifts to your neighbor and enjoy yourself. So we'll look a little bit at this beauty queen turned political activist here. Now this says, it begins in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over the 127 provinces. Now, we don't know of any Persian king named Ahasuerus. So people have guessed, well, maybe this was Xerxes the First. He reigned in the 5th century, about 480 or so to 460. And actually, there are documents which record that there was somebody in his court named Marduka. So maybe that was Mordecai, or maybe the name Marduka was just a very common name. It's difficult to tell. Actually, as an aside, the names Esther and Mordecai, which we have in the book of Esther as the two main characters, they are taken from the Babylonian pantheon. And actually, Esther is a version of Ishtar, and she was the goddess of love and war in the Babylonian pantheon. And Mordecai's name is taken from the name Marduk, and he was the head god in Babylon too. So it's interesting. Perhaps just common names, the most common names of that culture, or perhaps some claim that the real stuff that's happening isn't in the heavens up here, but it's all, it involves the survival of the people in this kind of drama. Esther has a Hebrew name too. It says Hadassah is her name. I don't know if you've heard of the Hadassah Institute. It's a Jewish organization of women that collects money for things like hospitals and other charitable organizations. So Hadassah, her name, this means the myrtle plant, you know, like the crepe myrtle plant. But her Babylonian name is Ishtar, or Esther. So you see, now you have the people living in a foreign culture and adopting some of the foreign ways. And Esther, in fact, hides her identity for a long time because it's not safe. Okay, so here we have a depiction of a very luxurious festival. It really sounds like Persia. It sounds like one of those stories from 1001 Nights, you know, Arabian Nights. In the days of Ahasuerus, okay, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and servants, the army chiefs of Persia and Media, and the nobles and governors of the provinces being before him. While he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his majesty for many days, 180 days. Okay. So then he had a little party after that. And it describes all the things in his palace, all the gold and everything. Very sumptuous settings here. And it says, drinking was according to the law. No one was compelled. It says that the king had given orders to all the officials of his palace to do as every man desired. Whatever people wanted, they could do during this festival. So we begin with a festival and we end with a festival. But now this festival sets up the whole story here. It says in verse 9 that Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So we're introduced to this queen, Queen Vashti. And there's no Queen Vashti in the records here that we have of the Persian Empire. So it seems like we're dealing here with a good story rather than with historical records. Okay, so we have these two parties going on. I would have somebody read, but there's a lot of names. I don't know. Does somebody want to brave it? Starting on 10. This is chapter 1, verse 10. Okay, yeah, just down to 12.
Sure.
Okay, go
this
for
is,
it.
This is RSV. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served King Ahasuerus as chamberlains, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, conveyed by the eunuchs. At this, the king was enraged, and his anger burned within him.
Mm-hmm. So we have here at the introduction a defiance of the royal decree. And you get this picture here on the seventh day, after drinking for 7 days with his buddies, you know, he's going to show him his wife. And according to Jewish tradition, it says that Queen Vashti was supposed to come before the king with her royal crown. And the tradition is that she was supposed to come with her royal crown and nothing else.
Yeah.
Kind of a strip tease here. But notice she refuses. She puts her foot down and the king gets angry. The king's always getting angry. Then, this is funny, he can never decide what to do himself too. You see this character who's just, he becomes enraged and then he doesn't know what to do with his anger. So he calls all of his counselors here and he says, well now, you know, the queen's defied my order, so now what am I going to do? And rather than seeing this as just an isolated incident, well, here we have a battle of the sexes going on, because one of his counselors here says in verse 16, actually somebody could read that too, Memucan says in the presence of the king and the princes, this is in 16, and it goes on down to 20, 16 to 20, somebody would read that. Thanks.
Then Memucan said in presence of the king and the princes, not only to the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also to the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt upon their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the ladies of Persia and Media will have heard of the queen's behavior, will be telling it to all who have heard of the queen's behavior, will be telling it to all the king's princes, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go forth from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be altered, that Vashti is to come no more before King Ahasuerus, and to let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. 20 also.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. So yes, very important.
So the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low.
There, yes, yeah. Important.
That's
So here we have an act of disobedience, and notice, okay, this is seen an affront to the whole system here. It's going to get all the women all organized and riled up. They're going to rally and they're going to all start saying no to their husbands too. So what do you do? Queen Vashti refused to come. Well, let's prohibit her from coming. It's kind of like standing out right at sunrise and saying, I command the sun to rise, and you know, thinking that you have a lot of power here. So she wouldn't come, so forbid her from coming. That's one way to do it, I guess. Keep the women in line here. So Vashti is sent out to kind of the pasture land there, and they're going to find a replacement, someone better. This is so that women will obey their husbands. When you have to start making laws like that, you know the battle is pretty much lost. And as we'll see, it's Esther's disobedience of the king, too, that saves her people. So, Vashti's gone. And then we have a beauty contest, because if you notice, in chapter 2, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. And there seems to be kind of a sadness there. He kind of remembers, I used to have this wife. But his friends, his counselors are saying, oh, well, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint fish officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the capital, and so forth. And let the maiden who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. Now this pleased the king, and He did so. So, they're going to have a big beauty contest.
It's good to be the king.
And this really is like Arabian Nights, because all these beautiful virgins come and they anoint themselves for 6 months with myrrh, and then six more months with other kind of ointments and spices and so forth. So you have like the 6 month beauty regimen, and then they have one night to please the king. They can bring anything they want into the chamber, but the only thing is that if he doesn't call them by name again, well, they're not killed, but they are sent off to the harem, and they just live there in seclusion for the rest of their life. So it's a big challenge for a woman. And
can
Esther,
I refuse?
Would you refuse the king? Well, anyway.
Me, personally?
Well, Vashti tried it.
I'm just really struck. Uh-huh. The guy says that. Give her royal position to another who is better than she, and it turns into a beauty contest.
Right. Uh-huh. More beautiful, more pleasing to the king. Right. More compliant,
uh-huh.
I'd say. Yeah, you can refuse the king, but then you get sent off to the pasture land here, off to the harem, and you're just closed up. So there's this big beauty contest, and everyone has their knight. Well, then we're introduced to these other characters here, and these are the important characters for the rest of the story. This is in 2:5. It says that actually somebody could read that from 2:5 on to 11. 2:5 to 11, introducing Esther.
A certain man, a Jew, happened to be in Shushan, the castle, and his name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite.
Yeah, just to pause very briefly. Now, that's Kish is the father of Saul. So we have somebody in the lineage of King Saul. And when we are introduced to the enemy, the arch enemy here, Haman, he's the son of, he's an Agagite. And Agag was a king of the Amalekites that Saul fought. So if you were, if you knew the biblical story, you'd know that these are ancestral rivalries. So, yeah, thanks.
Who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the deported people who were taken into exile with Jeconia.
That was the last king.
What?
Yep, yeah, that was the last king of Judah.
The king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, took into exile. And he came to be the caretaker of Hadassah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his father's brother, for she had neither father nor mother, and the young woman was pretty in form and beautiful in appearance. And at the death of her father and her mother, Mordecai took her as his daughter. And it came about that when the king's word and his law were heard, and when many young women were collected together at Shushan, the castle in charge of Haggai, then Esther was taken to the king's house in charge of Haggai, the guardian of the women. Now the young woman was pleasing in his eyes, so that she gained loving kindness before him, and he made haste to give her her messages and her appropriate food, and to give her 7 selected young women from the king's house, and he proceeded to transfer her and her young women to the best place of the house of the women. Esther had not told about her people or about her relatives, for Mordecai himself had laid the command upon her that she should not tell. And day after day, Mordecai was walking before the courtyard of the house of the women to know of Esther's welfare mm-hmm. and what was being done with her.
Thank you. Okay, so fortunately for her, she's beautiful and lovely. And then she wins favor and she kind of moves up the ladder here. Well, her turn comes to go into the king after these 12 months of beautifying. And this is down in 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So she's very prudent. First of all, she doesn't disclose her identity because they're living in the diaspora. And then next, she's prudent. She asks well, what, you know, what should I bring? And she follows instructions. So she's really very cautious woman in this first part of the story, as opposed to Vashti, you know, who says no. And the once again, rabbinic tradition has it that it says she asked for nothing except what Haggai the eunuch, who had in charge of the women, advised. And according to rabbinic tradition, she asked for nothing. She went in with nothing, just her bare self, and it was so pleasing. The king loved her more than all the women, and so he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And there was a big party. So now we have a new queen, the new compliant queen, the quiet queen, who asks for advice and who does everything that she's told to do and so forth. And if you look, she's also compliant here in 219 or 220. It says, now Esther had not made known her kindred or people as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. So very compliant, lovely woman, and she's become the king. Well, Mordecai keeps looking after her, and one day when he's sitting on the king's gate, he overhears these two eunuchs of the king, these servants, Bigthan and Teresh, and they are plotting to take the king's life. So he overhears this, and he tells Esther about it, and so these two servants are executed. And this is recorded in the king's chronicles that Mordecai saved the king's life. And this is important later on in the story. Well, then now we're introduced to another character in 3, Haman the Agagite. Now, he's been promoted. He's achieved a very high position, and he's very proud of his position. And so when he walks down the road, everyone bows down to him, and he feels very good about himself. But there's Mordecai sitting on the palace steps, taking care of Esther and inquiring about her welfare, and he refuses to bow down. And this really irritates Haman, because Mordecai's the one person that doesn't bow down to him. And so this happens day after day. So finally he sends his servants and says, what's the deal here? Why don't you bow down like everybody else? And Mordecai says, well, because I'm Jewish and we don't bow down to any person. You know, we only worship... Well, it actually doesn't say we only worship God. It just says we don't bow down to any person. And this really makes Haman so mad. And he finds out that he's Jewish, and he says, well, let's just kill all these Jews. So here we have the beginning of the real story here, the plot to kill the Jewish people. So he comes to the King Ahasuerus after... casting lots and finally deciding on the day that the Jewish people should be killed. And in 3:8 here, it says that Haman went to the king and said, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not for the king's prophet to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So here Haman depicts these people as, you know, sort of a rebellious people, and he offers to pay a certain sum of money if they'll be destroyed. And the king says, oh, okay, and gives his signet ring. And once again, a very weak picture of the king who acts on impulse here. So everybody is informed throughout all the provinces by a letter that on the certain day, on the 13th of this month of Adar, that all the Jews in all the provinces, in all 127 provinces, will be put to death, will be executed. This is sealed with the king's signet. And as we found out in his order about Vashti, that the order of the king can never be changed. The order of the king of Persia can never be changed. So when Mordecai then found out about that, then he tears his clothes and he puts on sackcloth and he goes around mourning, and all the people also, all the Jewish people are fasting and so forth. And Esther hears about Mordecai sitting in sackcloth on the steps, and first she tries to send him some nice clothes and, don't, you look kind of sad there, what's going on? Come on, dress up a little bit more. But she learns then about this edict. She learns all about how her people are going to be destroyed. And then Mordecai asks her to go talk to the king and try to get the people saved. But Esther's very worried here. Would somebody read 4:11? This is her answer to Mordecai. She's afraid to take action. Actually, somebody could read from 4:11 to 4:17.
All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. And I have not...
And he will eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, who is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him.
Okay, great. So here everything turns around. And at first Esther is afraid that she'll be killed. She's always been cautious up to this point. She's hid her identity. She's done everything that the head eunuch has told her. She's obeyed Mordecai and so forth. But now her caution is getting in the way. Because she's in this high place and she alone can save the people. This is an important phrase here when Mordecai tells Esther here that she shouldn't count on her high place as granting her any special immunity here. And this is that passage that I think speaks most directly about God's providence behind the scenes in this book here, when it says, "Think not that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another quarter. But you and your father's house will perish." So another quarter. Actually, this word that's translated in this, the Revised Standard Version, as quarter, in Hebrew it's Makom, which means place, and actually that became one of the names of God in later Jewish tradition. So here's a hint that there's some providence working behind the scene. But notice here that Esther then calls a fast and directs Mordecai, and in 17 Mordecai goes away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So Esther becomes a woman of action here and decides to take the risk, and Mordecai then follows her advice. So we have next this scene of Esther coming into the inner court of the king's palace opposite the king's hall, and seems like she holds back a little bit, but the king sees her, and fortunately, she finds favor in his sight, and he holds out the golden scepter, so she's not killed right away. And in fact, he's so pleased with her, he says, "Oh, Queen Esther, what can I do for you? I'll give you half of my kingdom if you ask for it." And she just says, "Well, I'd like for you and Haman to come to dinner." So she invites them to a dinner party, and Haman's very pleased. And so the king and Haman go to her quarters and they have dinner. And once again, the king says to her, "Oh, Queen Esther, what can I do for you? I'll give you half of my kingdom." And she says, "Well, why don't you come to another dinner party?" It's like she kind of loses her nerve. "Come to another dinner party, you and Haman, tomorrow." So Haman goes away feeling pretty good because he's dined with the king and queen, and he's going home to tell his wife and all of his friends about how successful he's been, when
of course, he passes Mordecai, and Mordecai doesn't bow down to him, and once again, he's just really irritated by this. So he goes home and he tells his wife, you know, I had dinner with the king and queen, but that guy Mordecai really bugs me. I saw him again. And his wife says, well, look, why don't you build a gallows and just hang him, and then you'll be able to have more fun at the feast with the king and queen tomorrow. So Haman says, oh, good idea. So he goes out and he builds this tall, tall gallows, preparing to kill Mordecai. However, well, now we switch back to the palace of the king, and the king can't sleep.
This is his wife's idea.
This is his wife's idea. Right. Yeah, the women are really running the show in this whole book, which is really funny because, you know, at the beginning it's like a kind of a controversy about who's in charge. No, we men are in charge. It's a law. We men are in charge. But if you look, it's really the women who are running the different plots of the book. Yeah. So here, switch back to the king's palace in chapter 6, and the king can't sleep. And so, of course, what he does when he can't sleep is he has people read about his rule and all the things that have happened in it. So somebody's reading him the chronicles of his reign. And they come to the part where these two eunuchs, these two servants, almost killed him, and it's mentioned that Mordecai alerted the palace about this plot and saved the king's life. So he asks, well, what was done to Mordecai to honor him for this great service that he's rendered us? And people say, well, nothing was done. So King said, oh, this is an oversight. We have to do something. And Haman happens to be walking by at that time. So he says, Haman, come here. And notice here, this is in chapter 6:6. Somebody read 6:6 to 6:11.
So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes. Let him array the man whom the king delights to honor, and let him conduct the man on horseback through the open square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, make haste, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he arrayed Mordecai and made him ride through the open square of the city, proclaiming, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of sort of poetic justice in all of this book here. Poor Haman, he's so embarrassed. He covers his head on the way home, and he tells his wife what happened. And the wife, Zerah, she knows here, says, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. And it says, and while they were yet talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and brought Haman in haste to the banquet that Esther had prepared. So now we're at the second banquet. And once again, the king asks the queen at this banquet, Queen Esther, what can I do for you? Even half of my kingdom I'd give to you. And then Queen Esther answers, if I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have held my peace.
for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. And then King Ahasuerus asks her, who is he and where is he that would presume to do this? And Esther said, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. And then Haman was in terror before the king and queen. So the king's so angry again, he goes off into the garden. He can't control it anymore. And while he's gone, here, this is another humorous part here. While he's gone, Haman stayed to beg his life from the queen, from Queen Esther, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine. As Haman was falling upon the couch where Esther was, and the queen said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? So, things aren't looking too good for Haman. And then one of the eunuchs says, yes, and not only that, but he built gallows to hang Mordecai, whom you honored. And so the king says, hang him on that. And he's taken off and hung on the very gallows which he prepared. And then the king's anger abated. He's certainly shifting character. Not too reliable if you're, a foreign people living in his midst. Always dependent on his mood. So King Ahasuerus gives Queen Esther Mordecai's property and so forth. And then Mordecai is given the signet ring. So the king gives over power to Mordecai, who becomes second in command here. But now the problem here is that we know that the decree of the Persian king can never be revoked. So you still have this day coming up, the 13th of Adar, when all the Jews are going to be executed, annihilated. So the king says, well, we can't change the law, but you guys can write a new law. So they decide to send out to all the different provinces a new law sealed with the signet ring saying that all the Jews can gather to defend themselves and to kill all their enemies. So this is sent out here. And when this day comes, then there's a well, it says that when this was announced, this is in 8:16, the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor, and in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict came, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many from the people of the country declared themselves Jews, for the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. So you now you have all the Persians passing as Jews, whereas Esther had passed as Persian for so long here. But when this day comes, then there is a great slaughter, and it talks about all the numbers here. Even in the capital itself, 500 were slaughtered, and so great victory here. And then it says the 10 sons of Haman were hung too. Very bloody scene here. Now, then the king asks Esther what she wants again. And then Esther asks for another day so that people can slaughter more enemies in the capital. So there's an additional day of killing in the capital of Susa here. And she also asks that 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. So this was all done. It says they didn't take any plunder, they just killed everybody. So it says the total body count was 75,000. And then they had a big party on the 14th and then the 15th day. And this was recorded, and then there was the institution of this annual commemoration of this day. It says in 922, it was the day on which these days were the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending choice portions to one another and gifts to the poor. So, this is the story of Purim and how this festival was initiated here. And then there's a little bit more about how the festival was instituted and so forth, and that Mordecai was very very high up in the whole structure here. He was next in rank to King Ahasuerus and great among Jews and popular, and he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. So the people will say, although the bloody slaughter.
Always interesting. That last verse, it's like Esther did all the work and all of a sudden Mordecai gets all the credit.
Right? That's the way it always is. A lot of people have said that, well, for example, Luther is one example, has said that he didn't find much value in the Book of Esther because it was so violent, and that it was very nationalistic, and he thought it was sort of a heathen book. And in the earlier session, there was a pastor here. He said, "Yeah, I don't think I've ever preached on the Book of Esther." Now, it's a tale of the Jewish people. We count it yearly. It definitely has a function in the lives of the people because, you know, throughout history they have been put into danger, and it's almost a melodrama of that kind of cycle of being in danger of annihilation and then, you know, succeeding to live. It's had a problematic place, and actually also in the second century AD, the rabbis were also discussing whether it should be included in the biblical canon or not. I think that it was included because it already had a festival at which it was read, so, you know, practice does tend to perpetuate beliefs and stories and so forth. So I think that's probably the reason that it was preserved. And it is definitely a story of taking responsibility within history, you know, for preserving the people. Esther's not given any divine commands or anything like that. It's more like in our times, you know, we probably don't hear voices speaking to us, telling us what to do, you know, having theophanies, divine appearances and so forth, but she kind of takes it upon herself to save the people. So anyway, I'd be really interested in reactions or comments about the Book of Esther. If you find it a good story, relevant, things you found interesting in it, if you find Esther as a role model, perhaps also if you see Esther as being different from the earlier women that we looked at. Some of you have been here for a few more times.
Real quick, was it common practice for persons of other nationalities, such as Mordecai, to achieve high positions?
Well, you know, it's like the Henry Kissinger syndrome, kind of, because you have also the story of Joseph rising to second rank, and you have Mordecai at second rank. It's almost kind of an ideal of a people who are living
under a foreign government. You know, you can't be president, right? Unless you're born in the United States, but you can have any other post, right? And kind of the same thing. It's an ideal to rise in power under foreign governments in the Bible, anyway. So
it's historically common.
Well, we do. If you look at, there are names of officials that seem to be. It depends on, you know, where you look and so forth, but. I think that if we decided to do a survey or whatever, you'd find that there were peoples with different sounding names, you know, different ethnic groups within the government of, well, like the Babylonians or the Egyptians. For a long time, there were Semitic names within the Egyptian government during a time when, I guess, the Hyksos, this was like 1500 BC or so. So there is some evidence that peoples of different nationalities work within the governments. But
seems like one part of the conquest cycle. You mentioned removing the wealthier folks, but it may also be the leaders and the you know, the people who could contribute to your society.
Oh,
be
true.
The ones that are pulling out of
right.
your conquered peoples, and so. There might be sort of a natural tendency for some of those to, if they were cooperative with the new government, to go ahead and rise.
Yeah, that reminds me. I'm glad you said that, because if you remember the book of Daniel, it actually is a story of that, where Daniel and his three friends are taken into the king's palace, and they're educated along with the you know, sons from different other ethnic groups, and then they serve in within the king's court. So there's another example of that. Right.
Esther, when I was a kid, was one of my favorite Bible stories. And I suppose it's because of that a woman is. The part that I always liked as a kid was where she goes to the king, and where she tells him, I perish, and she bravely, and I really got into this thing about, you know, the guards standing there with their swords drawn. There was a book about her. Their swords drawn, ready to strike her down, and he let her speak. And I really found her quite a role model at that age. And I forgot about what was killing later on, you know.
Yeah,
there's only, what, two books of the Bible with women's names?
Ruth
was real sweet and everything, but. But Esther was really the one.
Yeah, she defies the king's order, really, you know, goes in his presence, takes that risk of dying. Yeah, very brave, a portrait of bravery, I guess, for her people.
I mean, now she seems much more, but at the time.
Back then, yeah, what were your choices?
I think it, for me, raises the issue of somehow the oppressed, once given a position of power, always becoming, not always, but it seems to be very common, for them to become the oppressors. Well, I'll say it and you can react, but it seems to me that in a lot of cases, even the way Jewish people are not dealing with the Arabs and the Palestinians, and use the fact that they have been unjustly oppressed before, and they use that as an excuse in order to justify their own complete bloody oppression of Arab nations. And that's mainly, as we read this story, seemed like a real common link. And for me, the grace of the Hebrew God and the mercy of the Hebrew God that I experience in my life is not evident to me in this story at all through the people, you know, through God's chosen people, the Jews. I'm looking in this story for grace and for example, and don't see that at all.
But in the story of Esther, when the decree went out to kill the Jews, the Jews were not allowed to fight back. But when the second decree went out, the Jews were allowed to fight back, so to speak. So
they
were given
defense.
But they were given the they were given the option, therefore, then to go ahead and annihilate the enemies that were coming to attack them.
But the people attacking them were just doing the king's order.
And there's a difference between raising your sword to stop a sword, which I definitely support. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between that and slaughtering 75,000, getting drunk and going out for some more blood, which is kind of the feeling I get from this story.
Well, you some know, of those 75,000 were probably the Jews.
Yeah. Well, the thing is they didn't take the plunder, which mm-hmm. meant that they were, idealistically, they were doing it as a self-preservation more than a...
But you haven't picked on this for the second day.
The second day didn't seem to have any, any place in self-defense. But yeah, it is phrase is self-defense at first, but all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, let's have another day. Let's, you know.
Well, the second day was not, mm-hmm. yeah, it was different.
So, at least the first day was kill or be killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The second
mm-hmm.
day was
Mary Sophie. You know, just like, hey, that was fun.
Let's do it again. It kind of depends on, you know, how you read it, too. If you read it in the context of this kind of, you know, what raucous festival as sort of a fairy tale almost, you know, and the fairy tales that we tell our children, too, often the evil person is killed or whatever, you know, there's conquest of the good over the bad, so it's a melodrama. And you know, I don't know how seriously you want to take it, but there is that that element that the oppressed feels like the underdog, you know. And so God's on our side, but then when they gain power, they sometimes, you know, still feel like the oppressed or whatever, and that didn't quite fit as well anymore.
And I can remember having a discussion with a Jewish student who went to my university about Esther, and we discussed Esther, and he kind of used that as an example of justifying. We were talking about the whole issue, and I don't know, I mean, I just sometimes wonder, based on the Bible, what makes the Jews different than any other oppressed group? You know, what makes them different and what justifies this kind of slaughter then, because we're supposed to applaud it at the end of Esther, you know, and...
I mean, I really doubt that this was a historical story anyway, that, you know...
But it's whether like it's historical or not, it's part of Hebrew folklore, mm-hmm. I mean, which makes it very important. It's mm-hmm. part of our Bible, mm-hmm. and it makes it important, and I wonder what kind of example this book sets for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that, you know, whether it's historical or not, I think there's a lot of psychological truth in it. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, if we look at our contemporary society in the United States, violent people are people who have experienced violence as victims. And I think that's just a fact of life, that one of the most unfortunate results of violence is that it's soul-destroying. Mm-hmm. And it prevents people from developing compassion, so that they then become violent. And whether that's the way it should be or not, I think it's a psychological reality. It's a fact of human development. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to counteract.
So what's our call at the end of the book, though, is my question. As a Christian, am I supposed to be excited along with Esther and Mordecai and the king, or am I supposed to be disgusted? You know, I wonder what my call as a Christian is.
Yeah, and I don't know. I just think that what's, I mean, if in fact the Jews were oppressed and then got into a position of power for a brief time and became oppressors, it seems to me, I've seen that happen a lot as a psychologist working with offenders.
And not only among, you know, Jewish people either, but I mean,
it's a human potential, you know? It's part of our potential as human beings is to be violent.
Because the book ends with saying, and Mordecai was honored
and for his, and he sought the welfare of his people
of his
and
people.
Spoke peace to his people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last word.
Mm-hmm.
Just interested in spoke peace to his people.
Mm-hmm. So they preserved the people. Mm-hmm. Peace to
yeah. I kind of wonder if, you know, even though this is in the Christian Bible, I mean, I think, you know, you do have to look at it as an Old Testament, and that theme throughout the Old Testament of the preservation of the
mm-hmm.
God's chosen people, and you know, if you see the story in that light, I guess when I read that, and they took no plunder, kind of those lines, I mean, I don't quiet myself, but I mean, I think if you look at it from a literary or a story point of view, I think that it seems to me, in your Jewish people, I think that would be sort of a line that would imply to me anyway that this idea that this wasn't just a rampage, you know, where we're just going to take over the thing, but this is, you know, to use the Gulf War language, a surgical strike, that this was a this was a punishment of the enemy of the people, and so this was sort of God working to eliminate the enemies, not for the plunder and the gain, but because these were people who threatened God's chosen people. I'm not really disagreeing with your argument.
And then again,
but I mean,
if
you look at it from
a fill in the narrative, you can say, well, I'm Joe, not Jew, sitting there going, well, there's a decree that I'm supposed to exterminate the Jews. Holy cow. I mean,
right, you're right.
You know, I'm in between a rock and a hard place there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I just have problems with the book. It makes
mm-hmm.
me feel really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think that's where you get into that instant conversion now.
Yeah, I'm a Jew. I believe.
Yeah.
Was Esther in the ancestry of Jesus?
No, she's not mentioned.
Oh,
no, she's not mentioned. You have
Ruth
Tamar and Ruth and Rahab and Bathsheba.
Are
those
these
the four women?
Are Esther or any of the others mentioned other places in the Bible?
No, I don't. Esther is not. Rahab is actually a couple
yeah.
times in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
she's now I can't remember the passage, but she is the only woman mentioned. Maybe it's in Hebrews. There's a list, I think, that along with Abraham and others. So Rahab is, but no, Esther never is. No. And actually, at Qumran, you know, a lot of the books of the Bible are found, and many copies of some of them, but the Book of Esther isn't found. So it raises interesting questions whether, you know, made the table of contents in that community, the biblical table of contents or not. Or maybe so another guy said, well, no, it wasn't in with the library because it was Purim. And they had it out, and then they were all wiped out. So, but anyway, yeah, I think, you know, your question about okay, so I'm not a Jew or whatever, and then we have to quit too. But maybe a couple people have other things to say. But I think when we look at the Old Testament as Christians, I think we've sort of adopted it as our story, flaws and all. So I think that we're the Jews and we're the Israelites and stuff there. I get real uncomfortable when we look at stories like this and start saying, oh yeah, the Jews are like this, they're like vindictive and stuff like that, because then there's that anti-Semitic strain that comes up again and again in Christianity. So I think that at least for myself, my attitude to the ethnic stories, the legends of the Jewish people in the Old Testament, is to take it as my own heritage and then critique it from within that, you know, so that I'm along with Esther, you know, killing, probably overdoing, and so then I question my own you know, actions in the world from that perspective. I don't know if that's helpful, but anyway, a last comment. What was your feeling about
Esther compared to the other women that we looked at there, or do you have something else to say?
I just thought it was really neat that Ben taking, watching out for Esther, taking care of her, even though she was doing okay without him, that he knew that the Jews were going to be, they were going to survive. They always have. Mm-hmm. And his just little statement, if you don't do it, God's going to do it through somebody else. So, you know, I thought that was kind of a hopeful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no question in his mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, you're absolutely right. Okay, it's going to happen. God's working behind the scenes.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, perhaps you were put in this position.
Exactly.
Which makes us question.
Of course, then that's kind of like having being told, this is God's will for you. We don't like that. I don't want somebody else to tell us God's will.
Any other final comments? We are out of time. I really appreciated the opportunity to look at some of these stories with you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.